Kino zu Hause, der DocFest München Podcast. Filmgespräche des Internationalen Dokumentarfilmfestivals München.
Please welcome to stage Mina Nanji and Sipiki Mundo. And as well, we also have Gudala Meinzold, the co-producer. Also, please give a round of applause for Gudula, because we have to appreciate our producers, don't we? Come a bit more to this side, because otherwise you will have the writing in your face. Yeah. Welcome. Thanks for coming all the way from the US, from Kenya, and from Lausanne. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for making this film. I don't know, it's always, I have watched it for so many times and I'm very emotional today. So yeah, maybe in the beginning, it's a very usual and common question, but maybe you can share with us why you wanted to go on this journey and to make this film together. And we were talking about this yesterday already in a workshop about co-creation, co-direction. Maybe you can share with us here too as well.
So we started this film a long time ago, 2015-ish. I'm Kenyan born, Indian heritage, and live in Los Angeles right now, but I always wanted to do a project in Kenya. And I read this book, which I've said before, but it was about the concentration camps in Kenya that the British had. And just really wanted to do something about this film, about this subject, and was lucky enough to meet Zippy in 2015. I knew I wanted to collaborate with somebody on this journey, and we met very briefly and very quickly decided to make the film after we had... I had met Wanjugu already, and she introduced us to her mother. We did one research interview with her where it was a very, very powerful, raw interview where she was just telling these extraordinary stories of how it was to live under colonial rule. And by the end of during the interview, we were all, including our young camera people and sound guy, all in tears. I mean, it was just such a powerful interview. So we just decided, yeah, we'll make the film.
Great.
Yeah, exactly. I think because this history is not available in schools, like in books. And I was very curious about the subject and I was researching for a fiction, but there was no information. And I thought this would be a great way to research. But 8 years later, we released the film.
8 years. Wow. What took it so long? Why? And how did you continue? I mean, you have to motivate yourself on and on again. So let us take part in that journey a bit.
Yeah, as we said, like we thought this film would take a year or two and we would be done. I think at the beginning, we had the idea of documenting the stories that had never been told, because this was the first time the elders were actually trusting someone with this information. And then very quickly we realized that our main character would carry us and the story forward, because she started saying, okay, yes, my father died. I'm looking for the remains. What can I do with the people who are alive right now? And that became her mission, to be able to resettle the people who are still alive as she continues with this journey of finding about the history and what happened to the elders.
It was a really long journey. As if he said, neither of us expected. I thought it would take 2 or 3 years maximum. I think the film went through various iterations. I mean, we originally conceived it as a more hybrid film, actually, where we would intercut testimonies from the elders with a kind of theatrical piece that was based on a one-act play about Dead End Kimathi. But we, you know, I think as Wanjugu became our main character and her journey took a completely different route to one of resettling people, That took a while to unfold, and then also we learned about the Kikuzi and their land struggle, which was a whole other strand. Mm-hmm. Also, funding took a long time. So initially, when we started out back in 2016, we were getting responses like, oh, this is a history film. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want historical blah, blah, blah. Colonialism's over. We need something contemporary. Mm-hmm. I think it really, at least I noticed it really changed when, after the kind of Black Lives Matter movement mm-hmm. in the US and the whole George Floyd thing.
Yeah.
'Cause I feel that really put the word and the meaning of decolonization on the map in a different way. And I think the US started to pay attention, Europe started to pay attention in terms of funding. And so suddenly our film became contemporary in that context. Mm-hmm. And that was when we got really the funds to really move it. It also coincided a bit with COVID, so that set us back mm-hmm. a little bit when we just couldn't move, basically. I was stuck in the US. Zippy sure. was in yeah. Kenya. And so about a year or maybe a year and a half.
You lost with...
We lost. Yeah. yeah. But in a way, that helped our project. I mean, certain developments didn't happen till after then. Mm-hmm. So in a way, if we'd taken a quicker time to make it, we wouldn't have made the film we made, if that makes
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, totally.
Because when Jugu kept going, like, she yeah, really... She just was like, yeah, I'm going to put on my mask. My people are still dying. I'm going to... Yeah, so she continued. So we filmed very little during COVID, but, like, mm-hmm. she had grown. Like, she yeah. she just, like, took off.
Wow. Yeah. Talking about money, the co-producer comes in. So, Gudula, maybe you can share with us when you got to know about this project, where and why you said you want to be part of it, or how did your collaboration come into existence?
Yeah, well, we are doing Authentica Films in Berlin and working always with filmmakers and producers from those countries, Latin America and some African countries. And we thought this story must be told, and it's very, we saw the first rushes and it was really impressing, Van Jugu's fourth, and we were lucky to, the possibility with the World Cinema Fund, by the Berlinale, and but it's not finished with this. We think the film is very important and we would like to bring it to Europe. Anyway, it's invited to important film festivals, but also to discuss it in a wider way, to get outreach with this interest in post-colonial issues in the academic circus, etc., and especially in UK. So that's now the idea to help there, because yeah, that's we are here. So I'm very happy to share this experience.
Yeah. Thank so that is what you're talking about. This is impact, like an impact strategy. You're an impact producer as well. And so do you have also screenings? I mean, you're talking about Europe now, but do you think of doing that also in Kenya?
Yeah, we have a grand impact plan. I think for us, I think what was really important when we started the film, that's why it took long again, because we knew that we wanted to have the rights to be able to show it in the deepest grassroots in Kenya, in the continent, and to every colonizing country. And I think that's what we have started doing. We will show it deep in the, everywhere we can in Kenya. And the purpose is to be able to help Wanjugu's work to resettle, and also to set the truth straight, because this is history that has never been told from the point of view.
Maybe you can and say a few words to that in terms of the safety also of Wanjugu, because I imagine it could also be a bit sketchy and dangerous for her to screen the film and be around. And how do you yeah, how do you provide a safe environment for your protagonist and for yourself as well? So, or can you tell us how it will be or what you imagine?
Yeah, when we started, she was in airport, you know, picking up calls. So we never anticipated this beat of the, you know, the just how dangerous it is for her. And I just to say that Wanjugu felt very safe with us, and she would actually call us to tell us what was happening so that in case anyone attacked her or anything happened to her, we would have this evidence to say, look, she told us this was, she was being tracked, she was being arrested, she was doing this. And we haven't screened the film in Kenya. We did some tests, and we had very like strong reactions of what can we do, how, when do we start. But in terms of safety, we are setting exit strategies for Wanjugu first, and then of course for myself, since we live there. But we are getting a lot of support from some embassies and some people. So it's, I can't talk too much about it. But yes, we know that it might be taken really well, but some people might not be as welcoming because it's exposing, you know, some organizations, some companies, some individuals. Yeah, but as you say, like, we have to tell the story because it must be told. But then we are working on safety measures.
Yeah, and I think also showing it first internationally also really helps, because once it's been shown internationally and gets some, you know, exposure and hopefully some critical response, and also with connecting with different partner organizations and NGOs and human rights organizations, all of that really helps us in Kenya. So if they decided, you know, they'll know, the government will know that, look, eyes are on this film and this character, and so don't touch her. You know, it would, yeah, like, exactly. if we showed it there first, I think that we couldn't do it, basically.
It would have been banned.
It would have been.
Is banned. It?
Yeah. Probably. I don't know. But I mean, it's complicated because actually in a way the present Kenya government is trying to show that they are supporters of the Mau Mau and the independence struggle. So in a way they're trying to show that publicly, and so they have to support, like they organize the state burial. But on the other hand, their real motives, they do not support the Mau Mau struggle, if you see what I mean. So publicly they want to, but want to show that they do, but because they
Why
are
do
elites.
They not? That's what I don't understand, really.
I think it's economic. It's
the economic,
it's power.
Responsibility they feel to the British.
So it's, well, yeah.
when we gained independence, the power literally was transferred from the British to the Kenyan elite, the people who were supported, but supporting the British. Mm-hmm. And even though the regimes have changed, the presidents have changed, the structures mm-hmm. has never changed, mm-hmm. right? And so the people still at the top are still, you know, they're still wealthy. They're the ones benefiting. They're part of these big multinationals. They're part of them.
Yeah.
So of course, yes, on the surface, it sounds like we're very cool. Mm-hmm. We are promising things on screen. But
they are afraid to lose their power.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they I mean, basically the British gave them the land that the British didn't give up. They sold the land to the Kenyan elite. And they gave them political power. And it's a very neo-colonial arrangement, right? So that still exists now. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. when you hear about, you know, tribal politics in Kenya, it's not really tribal, it's class. Mm-hmm. You know, it's class. It's rich and poor.
Yeah.
The tribes come in as a handy dividing tool, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, but even within the Kikuyu, who are probably the largest in number and have held, he's not Kikuyu now, but they've held, Kenyatta, the first president, mm-hmm. Was Kikuyu. So, you know, they always say, oh, it's Kikuyu against this and, you know, the other tribes or communities, as I like to call them. But really, it's about the rich and the poor, and the rich keeping their economic and political power, if that makes sense.
Totally, yeah. Totally. I could go on, but I also want to include the audience. Are there any questions you would like to ask?
Yeah, it wasn't a question, it was just a comment. And I just wanted to thank you for this film. This is very important that this kind of films are shown, or that we start to show these films. And I'm very happy that I've seen it. And I mean, I was kind of crying at some, you know, there were some parts which were very sad, but it's very impressive and very positive because the fight that this woman started is very important. And I think this film has to be shown everywhere in these colonial countries and everywhere in the world. And thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you.
Was there another one? I saw, yeah, here in the front. Oh, okay.
Thank you so much for telling this story and for the courage to do so. I was wondering, at what point did you feel that the story was done, like the film was done, because it's an endless cycle of, you know, and they're still looking for, you know, the remains, you know, all of that. People still need closure. And you've been telling this story for about 8 years. So at what point do you feel like I have gotten to that point whereby I needed to close this circle? Thank you.
I think we were actually trying to finish shooting, I think almost even a year before we did, but things kept happening. For me, I think with the passing of Mokami, I think that was kind of, for me anyway, a way of, it was, you know, it was such an emotional time. And when Jugu, after that, you know, did say she's going to keep on, you know, she's, and so it just seemed almost a natural way to end there. So, but that happened late. That was in May of 2023.
That was when we'd finished shooting.
I
think we had a dream of finishing the film when we found Kimathi's body. And very soon we realized that would never happen. And so we kept figuring out. So we used to, then there was like, there was action by the British, you know, boycott. We're like, oh, that's a good ending because that's the start of a new thing. And then so there was always, oh, then the Queen dies. And then I think like when the Queen and Mokami died, we were not intending to shoot anymore. We had finished the film. So these were the very last scenes that we shot and we knew for sure we had finished the film. But otherwise there was always, oh, we've ended. not really. Yeah,
there is a, you know, just to update on the looking for Kimathi's body, there is now a real search. And now I think it's the Argentinian forensics that have been brought in. You know, there are actual concrete steps that are being taken now to really search for the remains. And so we had originally, we had filmed some of those meetings between the forensics people and Wanjugu and other representatives, thinking that, okay, if we end with this more official search, you know, that would be kind of the end of our film, but the beginning of part two, maybe, or somebody else could take that on. But so that was one, you know, one thing. But then it didn't, you know, things just take so much time to progress. So it seemed like that might be another 10 years before that happened. So,
yeah, there were two more questions in the front here.
Thank you so much for the film. Yeah, thank you. I have several questions. I start with one. How about the land issue? Not only concerning Mau Mau people, or is there, or is, yeah, how does it look like for the rest of Kenyans?
So many Kenyans were dispossessed, right? Of course. I think now in the last, you know, 5-10 years, there has been a lot of organizing at the very grassroots level. So one group is Kikuzi, that was not originally in touch with Wanjugu. We were just talking earlier, there's an area in Kenya called Kericho that is a lot of the tea production happens there. And they've also, there are groups organizing around that. And all these things are coming together. And they are being actually looked at even in the British Parliament. So a few years ago, there were about 12 or 13 MPs, members of Parliament in Britain, who were trying to get a resolution passed that would make it, you know, compulsory for the British government to look into how do they compensate for land. But it's a huge problem because, you know, still so many people are impoverished because they don't have land, right? So if they don't have land, they can't grow their own food to subsist or to sell. So if they can't grow their own food, they have to go into wage labor, right? So it becomes this cycle of just remaining in kind of an impoverished state. So land is really the first step, but it's a countrywide issue. And of course, the multinationals, even the so many government officials who do own vast amounts of lands, even sort of British who pass their land down to descendants or, you know, that still takes up the most fertile, most beautiful land.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, especially with, yes, there's the individuals, all the old people you've seen, there's like thousands and thousands of them. They're all over. But for me, also, one of the biggest problems is the multinationals, because there's a lot of, like, you know, the British descendants who are still there, and they own like 80,000 acres, that, you know, and the government owns huge tracts. So for us, it's like, why can't the government, you know, just right now, there's just like a lot of free land, like that's not being utilized. Like that, for me, that was what was logical for Wanjugu to be allowed to have this land. That's what she thought when she started, like, now she's buying like 10 acres, whatever, which is not sustainable, right? So she thought that if she brought the masses, the government would have the goodwill to be able to say, okay, I see what you're doing. You've brought 50,000 people. Okay, we have 200,000 acres that is lying free. But yeah, because of what we've talked about, just because of how the structures are, that has never happened. And so they keep fighting. I guess this film, we will use it to be able to really show the scale. Because I think when you read a book or an article, it's not that. But if you watch a mother and daughter, you know, kind of from nothing and growing this huge following, I think then it touches you.
I believe that definitely too, and I hope that. I also have another question about the remains that were found in the film, like the mass graves that were found. Is there any idea or plan on identifying or putting together the pieces of the skeleton? Or is there other families also searching for their ancestors in the Mamo?
Not actively, but yes. I mean, if there was a call, you know, if Wanjugu said, look, we want to get these graves exhumed, we want to identify who these people are, there would be a lot of people who would, you know, I think join that, you know, to push the government to make it happen. I think there's several issues with it in that the colonial killings were not the only killings. So since independence or after independence, there have also been political killings by the government that they will obviously never cop to and never want to discuss. And they use some of those same sites for dumping people. So they would be probably very against exhuming certain sites, right? So it's a complicated issue. Because, you know, then you have to go to this whole other level of, you know, who's accountable, et cetera, et cetera. For the colonial era graves, I mean, I think, I don't know, I feel like there might be a chance of that happening. But there's, you know, people have life to deal with. And so it's almost like, yes, we would, of course, we want to find our loved ones. But it's maybe what takes precedence is like actually being able to live.
Just a quick one. Yeah. Just to the one that you saw, right? This family, the government knows it exists, but they refuse to even recognize it. I think over the past few years, they've been able to like map out. And I think Wanjigu was telling me that there's like now 24 like mass graves that have been gazetted. So they know exactly there's a mass grave here, here, like everywhere that there was a colonial post, there was a lot of dumping of bodies. And some of these sites have already started being at least to be recognized, because I think exhuming is a whole other thing. I think the first thing was for the government to accept that they exist first, and then we can move on to the next bit. But a lot of, you know, it is, I mean, Wanjigu keeps saying this is not my fight. There's like thousands and thousands of other people in Kenya who don't know where their loved ones were buried. So I think it's a first step to first show people that it exists. Mm-hmm. No one knew this place exists that is 20 minutes away from the city center.
And my last question would be, does Wanjigu, now that her mother died, will never know who her biological father is? Or she doesn't want to, or because, yeah.
She will never really know. yeah, so actually, why we actually brought it up in the film is because it's something that a lot of Kenyans were using to really like insult her and like diminish her work. And it's something that really, really hurt her. So I remember even... We kept saying, how are we going to ask that question? And then I said, Mina, you just pretend. Like, because in my culture, I would never ask the question. And so...
I could play the kind of, so, you know...
We used to do that.
Like, brash American and say, so, what about your dad?
No. Anyway, I think, yeah, so it was really something that a lot of people were using. You see, like, in the where she kind of reads the newspaper... It was way deeper than that. You know, people kind of started insulting her, like, wait, go look for your father, you know, things like that. And so we said, like, we have to address it in the film so that we recognize, because in our culture, if a man says that, you know, I want you to continue with the lineage and any children that you have after me will bear my name, like, that's a culture thing, and like it's something that we cannot talk about. And that's why I think even the mother never wanted to talk about it, but she told her the story since she asked. But rarely would people ask, and she would never, unless there's a man who comes and says, now I'm the one. But I don't think Wanjigu is looking.
But it's also, I think Wanjigu also really, really you know, she really took it on. I mean, she said, look, this is how, you know, you don't have to be the biological descendant of somebody to be part of the family. You know, I was raised by my mother. I was raised by by the spiritual side of Kimathi is in her. And I think it's kind of remarkable, actually, how she's, you know, her mother for sure, you know, gave her the incredible leadership quality she has, but she's also inhabited it in a really powerful way. And, you know, taking on the Kimathi name has really empowered her in that way. And she uses it for, you know, she uses it in a way where that name and that sort of power that is held in that name is spread, you know. So in a communal community building way, I think.
Thank you. Hello. I also have two questions, if that's okay. First of all, thank you so much for the film. It's a really powerful film with so many different stories that come together. And I think many of these scenes will haunt me a little in the weeks to come. So I'm curious, first of all, in how you as filmmakers view the sort of intersectionality between filming and activism. To what extent do you believe that they go together? Are there also situations where they are like mutually exclusive from each other? How do you as humans who are working on a film deal, you know, with sort of, you know, the act of holding a camera, like with people who are facing extreme levels of injustice? How do you also deal with the, with Ohnmacht? Ohnmacht? Powerlessness that you might also feel in these kinds of situations. Yeah, thank you.
I'll start very quickly. Actually, so the very first time that our character realized she was an activist was like a month ago. You know, yeah, we were at the Hague, And then there was the activist program. And then she was just like seeing all these activists like in the films. And she said, I've never seen myself as an activist. So for her, she was just doing the work, but she never had that label in it. So it's interesting for you to ask that. And I think for us also, of course, when you're starting the film, you don't realize the amount of responsibility that you have kind of undertaking this really, really powerful stories and listening and being kind of bearing witness to what people are experiencing. And for us, I think because we are not activists, but we are making stories that push the envelope. So I think our duty is to make the best film with the, you know, factual and a story that moves, to be able to, you know, kind of shift things and move things. And that's what we're saying, like, you know, with the impact strategy is to, using the film as a tool to be able to help anything. Like, how do we help Wanjugu's work? How do we kind of, the elders feel really ashamed because they were not told thank you for fighting the country. They were told, you know, put up your arms and go back to where you can. And they're like, I've been in the forest for 7 years. I don't even know where my families are. So I think it's also just honoring them and making them feel seen. You can continue. But like for me, like that's...
That's a big question. and I feel very pulled in different directions, I think. But I think when we went from, you know, originally conceiving it from being a more hybrid project, and perhaps it would have been less accessible, I think once just hearing the stories of the elders and wanting them to share wanting to share what they had to say in a different way, I think that's when, for me, in my head anyway, I thought, okay, making this film as accessible as it can be to a widest possible audience. So my I'm always torn between activism and aesthetics, and I mean, I think they can combine, and some people do it incredibly well. I still can't get that integration for what I would like, but I think. I think the activism side took over for me, and I just felt, okay, this needs to be accessible, and it needs to be, that's...
Maybe we have time for one last question. Is there anywhere? Oh, no. Yeah, Muhannad in the back there. Oh, sorry, did you have another one? No, we can go that and still have Muhannad, so we still have a minute.
Thank you for the previous answer. I'm also curious because, 8 years is a lot, like, in your lives as well, and I'm sure that, like, as filmmakers, you went through, like, a lot of developments. So I'm curious, like, how it was for you viewing back on footage from the beginning or from, like, from years back, like, how is your relation to the footage when maybe you had different ideas going into the film? Maybe you were interested in a different style at that point. Yeah.
Well, I think, watching the early footage, I mean, the stories are amazing, the interviews we did, and they were research interviews. We didn't realize that they, there was a real... unexpectedness and power in hearing these stories for the first time when they were being told for the first time, because just the emotion carried in speaking it for, I think, the at Chumvi, the woman and the man there, they were really telling it for the first time, and it was just, it's, you know, it just hits you, right? And Mukami as well, we used a lot of her original interview, the first interview we did as voiceover, but I think the quality of our recordings and our camera equipment and our, you know, the DP also developed with us. So I'm sort of, you know, the early footage is, I think it's very powerful in itself, but I think in terms of quality, you know, shooting wise and what it looks like, I actually prefer the later footage.
I mean, it's true. Of course, we started, when we started, it was just like, you know, oh, we had a dream first. Like, Mina came from experimental films, I came from fiction, so we were, like, going to, like, put the camera and things would happen. And, like, and then soon enough we realized things were happening and we had to run and find the story. So, like, the kind of idea of, like, kind of sitting and waiting stop. But I feel like the style of the film kind of came from where Wanjugu was taking us. Because there was a lot of places that we just followed, you know, like it becoming bigger and bigger. But also, like, before she was very like, let me dress up, I'm coming. And then, like, then she just started allowing us into her bedroom, you know. So I think and you can feel it, like we were really outside and then we just started coming, like, really intimate and they allowed us in. So as the crowds got bigger, we got more intimate. So I think for me, like, that really helped kind of to contrast the life at home, and because the story is so heavy, we kind of played a bit when they were at home. There was just, like, really light moments and kind of showing the family and contrasting it with the really tough government pushback.
Okay. So please give the mic to Natalie, and then one last question. It was Muhannad there with the white shirt.
I just wanted to ask if there was a screening in the UK, if you had a screening, and how was it? And if not, is there any planned in the future?
We have one coming up. I can't say where yet.
Yes, we can't say. But of course, we really want... We've been chasing a lot of British broadcasters from since 8 years ago. Literally, they would see us like, we know your film, and they would run. So we're still looking. Yeah, but we know that we will find partners and we'll be able to screen this, you know, in every little corner, every school, any university. So the strategy is, yes, we will show, you know, Good Lies here, waving, nodding, really. Yeah, but we haven't shown yet. We're showing soon. But the idea of the grassroots screenings in Kenya is the same, that we want to show it to the UK, because a lot of the UK audiences that have been in the audiences in the screens that we've done, they're so shocked. They're like, oh my gosh, like, we need to know this. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's just part of a big part of why we did the film, is to really try and at least start the change around, you know, to change the narrative around this era in Kenya, right? Because right now it is still described by the British perspective. It's always, you know, Kenya, you think of safaris, you think of gin and tonics on the bungalow balcony or something, right? And it's really to say, wait a minute, you know, this is from the Kenyan perspective. And because people in, you know, as well as this history not being available to Kenyans in Kenya, it's not available to the British either. And I feel like the British has also been bamboozled to think that, oh, we were the good colonizers, we were civilized, and we brought education and railways and this and that. And so, you know, the whole UK sort of, you know, trying to get into the educational system there to also kind of change language, change how this era is talked about, is a big, big part of what we want to do. So.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for making this film and breaking down the walls of silence. I think this is much overdue. And yeah, we will continue our conversation in the afternoon. Don't forget to vote for the film if you liked it. My colleague has the box over there. And I hope also to see you this afternoon. And yeah, see you later.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.